Shows you got intelligence. Wish the professor had as much sense. He's the meanest little man I ever met. Look here, what he done to my face?
We can't see in all this darkness, you fool, Tamara said. Stop spinning round like a ballerina. That don't help. Plus, we don't want to look at your face. Just say what you got to say and scoot.
In Velcro, next to the pistol, was a flashlight. Ford handed it to Purcell, who was 6'6" and weighed over 300 pounds.
I wouldn't mind having a look.
Purcell's sweaty shadow loomed over the table until the light came on. Ford cleaned his glasses and put them on again.
Are you sure we're talking about the same Dr. Nickleby?
Yeah, the professor,
the man said, and posed, offering a side view of his melon-sized head. One purple eye was swollen shut, a bandage under it, and his lower lip was crusted with blood. Injuries from a fight. Tamara's laughter started softly and got louder.
That little fellow did that? No one's going to believe you.
It ain't funny. My dog tooth, I think it's loose. No amount of beer I drink helps my headache neither. And it was even worse when it happened 4 or 5 days ago.
Oh, Lord, Sandman, get used to it. Did he have to climb on a stool to reach you?
Don't you be running your mouth about Professor Leo. That's my advice. Man's got a temper. What happened is he hit me when I wasn't looking with his damn fist due to a little misunderstanding. And him being a doctor, as you say.
Leo?
Ford asked.
That's what his girlfriend calls him. Her name's Liddy, something like that, or she calls him the professor, too.
Purcell touched a careful finger to his jaw.
I'm starting to worry. Think the bone might be broke?
That's not what worries you, Tamara said. I expect the man's in hospital now, or dead by the time you got done wiping the ground with him. Is that why you come here with your drunk talk, making threats before the constable hauls you off?
Purcell staggered a little as he placed the flashlight on the table.
Never touched the professor after he attacked me. I couldn't.
Because he's so small? I don't believe that neither.
Believe what you want. Most fellas run away when I get mad, so I just stood there after it happened, not sure what to do. Surprised, I guess, because no one ever had the spine to hit me before, which is what I told him. You know, in a threatening way to scare them both. That's when he hit me again. Damn near put me down.
Tamara had to slap the table.
Stop your damn laughing. Friends of mine was on the dock and saw it happen. Ask them if Professor Leo is a man to cross. They'll tell you that witch of a girl he's with, she's just as smart and meaner in her way. I think she hexed my boat somehow.
How?
I called her a witch, didn't I?
Funnier and funnier, Tamara said. You best get used to laughter. The only hex on you, Sandman, you put there yourself.
All I'm saying is I had nothing but bad luck since. One thing after another, then tonight, as I fired the engines, my GPS was blank as a roll of butcher paper. No, indeed, I don't want no more trouble from that pair.
Ford, closing his bag, getting to his feet, tried not to show amusement.
I've done work on marine electronics. What kind of GPS do you have?
Purcell was too busy seeking sympathy to respond.
All my waypoints, he said to Tamara. The best fishing and dive spots around. Spent years marking those places. Guess my only hope is to apologize to the professor and ask him to fix it right. Trouble is, that little misunderstanding I mentioned, those two might not feel charitable toward me.
Tamara wanted to know what kind of misunderstanding, but Ford interrupted.
Take me to your boat. I'll fix your GPS.
Purcell, startled, turned, comical almost, the hopeful look on his face.
I'd do most anything if that's true, sir.
We'll see.
Ford started toward the road. He didn't speak again for a while. Purcell's amended persona was deferential and dumb. An act, possibly. There were a lot of dangerous men with low IQs who were animal shrewd and had a gift for manipulation. And who had been hiding in the trees with a machete? When Tamara was far enough behind, he began to probe.
Your buddy should have joined us instead of running off like that.
Who are you talking about? If it's the boy I pay as mate, he's too drunk to run anywhere about now.
You came alone?
Hell yeah, man. Why I need help dealing with a tourist such as yourself?
Ford stopped and said, Gotta take a whiz. From the bushes he used the NV monocular to confirm they weren't being followed. A little later he asked Purcell,
Where are Dr. Nickleby and the girl staying?
At a hotel, I guess, as what most tourists do.
On Andros?
Nah, I think they left days ago. I ain't seen them anyway. I sure am sorry, sir, about giving you a hard time back there. I didn't know you and the professor was friends.
We aren't. Just mutual friends is what I said. That's why I'm looking for him. Did he happen to mention a couple of coins he wanted to sell?
Purcell took his time, formulating another lie.
Coins? Don't think so. You a collector, sir?
I'll pay a finder's fee if they're worth buying. You have to drop him and the girl somewhere if they're not on Andros, which island?
Hard to even remember, my head feeling like it does. Besides, that's something I'd have to get the professor's permission to share. When you say finder's fee, how much are we talking? Wouldn't want to waste my time making inquiries for less than my time's worth.
So he hasn't sold them?
No. Well, maybe one of the coins. You carry that much cash on you?
Ford illuminated his phone and showed Purcell the phone number he'd copied from the boat's logbook.
Call Nickleby and tell him I'm interested. It's a Bahamas area code. Your phone will work.
Purcell recognized the number. There was no doubt.
Tell you what, sir. Fix my GPS. We'll talk about it. That sound like a fair trade to you?
Like a threat is how it sounded.
You haven't asked how much I charge, Ford said, a mild threat of his own that Purcell misunderstood. The man was still bemoaning his list of gambling woes as they boarded the Sandman. There was a cell tower close enough. Ford's text to Tomlinson read, "Here's the number. Talk Nickleby in before he gets hurt."
7. Before the phone rang, a stranger named Tomlinson calling, Lydia was on the porch of their beach house. Below were tiki torches that illuminated a private pool. She'd been counting money, hundreds and fifties, but stopped when Leonard exited the bathroom and posed in front of the mirror. It made her feel good because he looked good, tanned with a hint of muscle definition after 7 months at her gym near Gainesville. That and some veterinarian magic used to bulk up Angus bulls. The clinic where she'd worked stocked a big selection. Professor Leonard Nickleby would never be mistaken for a bull, or an athlete for that matter, but try to convince him of that after 12 days in the Bahamas. "Where's my brilliant little sea wench?" Leering, he turned, nothing but a towel around his waist. God, it was hard not to laugh when he said stupid stuff like that. His silliest line was, "I've got the grog if you've got the stein," whatever the hell that meant. Well, it meant he was horny, but he was always horny. Another change in Professor Nickleby. Lydia gave herself credit for the change. Injections of vet-grade testosterone had played a role, but there was no anabolic fakery in the way their bodies meshed. Since losing her virginity at 21, she'd been with only 3 others, all bigger, younger, although not much younger, but none of them compared to the happy little bald man leering in the next room. The transformation had been so seamless it felt like they'd always been this way. That was not the case. Reassembling the man's shattered ego had required tenderness and an objective. "We have reservations, Leo," she said, the prelude to a game they played.
"Cancel him."
"What about dinner?"
"Had it yesterday."
"You'll be hungry."
"By tomorrow, who cares?"
"We could do room service."
"Precisely, my beauty. Then eat later at the bar."
Lydia, for the first time in her life, felt unexpected moments of being loved, safe and in control, yet inevitably, reality yanked her back into a mess of her own design. But Leonard was now ready, his towel on the floor. Afterward, he lingered in bed while she showered. The bathroom was spacious, marble with gold fixtures, double doors opened wide so they could converse.
"You know, maybe you're right," Leonard said from the next room. "Maybe I should get a doctor to take a look at this hand. Doesn't hurt. Not much, but the damn thing still looks swollen."
His right hand, the one he'd used to hit the charter boat captain 5 days ago. Leonard was like a kid with a trophy he didn't want to lose, a child whose timidity had produced scars only on the inside. This was another similarity they shared. Yet something Lydia had not experienced was the methodical humiliation by a spouse. Mrs. Rebecca Nickleby was 100 pounds overweight, and had tried to destroy her husband emotionally and sexually as punishment for her own self-contempt. Lydia, the armchair shrink, was also a rescuer. How else could she rescue herself? She felt a surge of unwelcome emotion, so turned her face into the shower before replying, "What's the problem, Prof? Can't hear you."
"My damn knuckles! I can't help thinking about the look on Purcell's face when I punched him. What the hell did he expect? I hated to do it, but even my patience has a limit. The big oaf had it coming."
"Leo the lion," she called out. "Yes, he did, but honey, try to keep your temper in check from now on, okay?"
"I didn't start it."
"Then the jerk threatens you? Makes me mad just thinking about what else I should have done."
That's not the way it happened. Leonard had caught Captain Purcell going through a waterproof pelican case that should have been locked and probably was. It contained the stolen logbook, their last silver Spanish real, and one extraordinarily beautiful gold doubloon. The stricken look on Leonard's face, pure terror, as the captain, giant-sized, had stepped toward him. Then, smack! Like a cornered animal, Leonard had fought back, before fleeing to the stern of the boat. Purcell had stumbled along in pursuit, then glowered at them both, that's all, before Leonard swung another wild fist. Again, the sickening sound of bone on skin. Blood, too. The giant, with a bewildered expression, while six of his buddies, watching from the dock, whooped and laughed. On the ferry to the resort, Stanley Kay, Leo the Lionhearted had vomited, he was so overwrought with nerves, but did it privately. Lydia had pretended to be unaware. Then, after a shower and three margaritas, presto, another transformation. Leonard had rallied on the beach by stripping her naked in moonlight and taking her from behind. Was this really the same nervous little man? His wolf-like growling had been unexpected. Very sexy in a way, but had also scared her. His inflated confidence still did. Captain Purcell could have crushed both their skulls with one bare hand. Lydia had helped create the new Leonard Nickleby. Now the problem was how to keep him under control and safe. She exited the shower and selected a towel of Egyptian cotton while speaking through the open doorway.
"Point is, we don't want to draw attention to ourselves. I think the locals got the word loud and clear about who not to mess with. That's all I'm saying."
"The Coconut Telegraph."
"You don't need to prove yourself again, Prof. What time are we supposed to meet that man?"
"Who?"
"The coin dealer, or collector, or whatever he is. I'm still a little miffed you didn't include me in the decision."
"There's a good example for you," Leonard said. "Primitive communication is always underestimated. Columbus, in his journals, wrote about the Taino people. Indios, he called them. Una gente en Dios, meaning a people of God. Why? Because they were naked. Savages, the Spaniards considered them. Isn't that a laugh from so-called explorers who slaughtered an entire race?"
Professor Nickleby, archaeologist, historian, lectured on until he finally got to his point.
"They used drums and signal fires. The Indians along the Florida coast knew about the Spaniards 40 years before they actually landed. Now it's cell phones. Same concept. Did you see the way the security guy looked at me when we checked in? I think they already know. Probably Purcell's pals. The story of our little fight has spread from here to Nassau."
The pride the little man felt was obvious. Lydia stepped out wearing a black sleeveless dress, local pearls, and high heels of raspberry red. She'd paid cash at the resort boutique, an outfit that cost more than the dented Toyota she'd left behind at the airport in West Palm.
"The coin dealer, Leo. What time?"
"My God, you look delicious. Come here, I want to show you something."
The stolen logbook, leather-bound, lay open on a desk. A chart of the Exumas, 300 islands, most of them deserted, was nearby.
"Fitzpatrick is a shrewd old bastard, but the amateurs are all alike in one way. They can't see the bigger picture. Not just historically, but in terms of hydrogeology. But why am I telling you? You worked for Benthic. Oh, yeah, the great Jimmy Jones, Mr. Bigshot Conman until a few weeks back, when his cellmate—"
"I know, I know. Let's not go over that again," Lydia said.
News of Jimmy's death had catalyzed too many barbs, an equal number of lies, and had led to their only blow-up thus far. Jealousy was new to her, flattering in a way, but enough already. Her hand massaged the professor's neck as she seated herself on the arm of the chair.
"Show me what you found."
Leonard hadn't found anything. He had hijacked an idea and formulated a theory. It was based on two small chunks of ambergris that Captain Purcell had plucked from the sea. Both were found in shoal areas, as directed by the logbook, but miles apart. Ambergris was a strange substance. It resembled gray volcanic rock, yet floated on the surface like styrofoam. Profitable. Very profitable. Because Lydia had insisted on a 50-50 split. This was before the big fight. God, the stuff stunk, which is why a buyer in Nassau had paid only $6 per gram, half the wholesale rate. 13 pounds equaled almost 6,000 grams, $37,400, cash, Bahamian dollars. It was Captain Purcell who had stumbled upon the idea. After losing his 16 grand playing roulette at the Hyatt, he had suggested, "Could be that book of yours is better at finding amber wax in some damn old wreck where there's sharks and other shit. Me, I don't like the water." Locals called ambergris by several names. Often, it was a humorous reference to whale feces. Leonard was terrified of sharks, too, but had become more assertive after 2 days aboard the filthy trawler Sandman. "Have I asked you to get in the water? Just punch in the numbers and run the boat like you're paid to do. There's a little reef ahead I want to check out."
"A captain does more than steer," Purcell had replied. "And he sure don't take orders. You got something against money? By rights, the way the law of the sea works is the boat gets a third, the captain gets a third, and that's what you and the missus should have got, not half."
"More for you to gamble away, in other words."
"Whatever I want to do, that's none of your business. What I'm saying is let me have a look inside that book. Maybe I'll find us another good amber wax spot."
This was the first sign of trouble. Leonard had been oblivious, already seeking a connection between wreck sites and coral intersections that had snagged blobs of ambergris. The results, paid in cash, now lay on the desk of their expensive beach house, far from the main resort.
"This is what your common treasure hunter types would have never figured out," Leonard said. "I'll show you."
He refolded the chart to display only the southern tip of Andros, Stanley Key, and the leeward rim of Cat Island. Several miles west lay a pair of tiny islands unnamed. They were joined like beads in a trough called the Tongue of the Ocean. "Think they're inhabited?" Lydia asked.
"Doesn't matter, because we won't need a dock," Leonard said. "See how the currents carry him toward deep water? Fits in his goddamn fake GPS numbers."
But he was sloppy when it came to magnetometer readings in shallow areas. The same with his notes on triangulation, most in Spanish, but some in English, like these spots. In pencil, Leonard had drawn arrows to indicate tidal flow where, years ago, Carl Fitzpatrick had marked possible wreck sites. The arrows formed whirlpool vortexes around several reefs. Picture a Spanish galleon being beaten to death in a storm. Hydrology, there's something called the Venturi effect. Current accelerates through constricted spaces. Imagine water shooting out of a garden hose. Then it explodes in reverse if the flow is deflected by a reef. He tapped the chart for emphasis. Thermoclines, denser water, have an effect too. In a storm, tidal velocity would have accelerated. See what I'm getting at? During her 18 months working for Benthic Exploration, Lydia had risen from deckhand to Jimmy Jones's smart little geek. Soon, she was his secret advisor that no one else on the project bothered to give a second look. At Jimmy's insistence, she had tended to his less savory needs as well. The concession had allowed her freedom to learn a great deal about finding small objects on the bottom of a big blue sea. It had also helped her appreciate Leonard, a man she might be falling in love with, something she hadn't planned.
"I feel dense, Leo. I hate you spending so much time on ambergris when we both know what we really want."
Their own private island. That was the late-night fantasy they'd chattered about like kids. Somewhere safe, remote, a sunny place where they could be themselves, without apology.
"Working our asses off to find what Fitzpatrick never found in the first place isn't the only way," Leonard replied. "You don't see it, do you?"
She listened patiently while he explained what she already understood. The whirlpool vortexes that positioned sunken objects along a reef also directed floating objects onto a reef.
"Then Captain Purcell was right," she said.
"Purcell? Christ, it was a lucky guess. You don't really give him credit for...
That's not what I mean. What worries me is Purcell made the connection. Those friends of his watching from the dock... When you hit him, they were scary, gangster-looking. They liked seeing his blood, and my God, the way they humiliated the man by howling like animals. What if they know?
About the logbook?
Any of it. The equipment we brought is worth a fortune to people like them. Purcell knows we're carrying a bundle of cash. And the coins. Are you sure he didn't see them?
Nickleby wasn't sure, but replied, How many times do I have to tell you? Yes, they were in the Pelican case, but in their own little boxes, like always.
Stop being such a nervous Nelly. But he was going through the logbook when not in a million years could Purcell or his pals figure out Fitzpatrick's notes. He's not smart, but he is smart enough to realize the book's useless without me beside him to... That's exactly why I'm worried. And he knows where we're staying, Leonard.
The girl seldom used his formal first name. Nickleby, seated, put his arms around her waist and pulled her closer.
How about this, tonight? If the guy makes a decent offer, we'll sell the other silver coin and buy our own boat. Something big enough we can live on for a while.
There's one at the marina I liked with a broker's sign on it. We spent a week or two looking for ambergris and used that money to finance a bigger boat, so...
He stopped, aware the girl had gone rigid.
What's wrong?
Don't worry, I can handle Purcell. His friends too, if it comes to that.
Lydia, from where she stood, could see beyond the patio to their private pool below. A man was there, white slacks, white Guayabera shirt, his bearing confident like he was there for a reason.
Is that your coin dealer?
Leonard got up. Too early. He is probably some tourist who wandered away from the resort. If you want, I'll... He started toward the door as the phone rang, their Bahamian BTC cell, prepaid a month in advance.
Get that, would you?
She did, and heard a kindly male voice say, My name's Tomlinson. Within 60 seconds you'll not only trust me, you'll thank me for... That's all she heard, because two men wearing masks were waiting as Nickleby opened the door. Before the feds confiscated it, Benthic Exploration had owned an ocean-going research vessel, the Diamond Cutter. It was outfitted in Norway with twin Storvik 4-ton cranes, an instruments bridge right out of Star Trek, and accommodations for sleeping 12. A little cabin aft, port side, with a porthole view of the sea, had been Lydia's home for a year. Sometimes, when the crew was off, it was just her and a maintenance guy or two anchored in a leeward cove where the water was clear and at least 20 feet deep since the vessel drew 15. Spearfishing had become her passion. Few things were more satisfying than sitting down to a meal of fresh snapper she'd stalked and filleted herself an hour earlier. When the men crashed into the kitchen and slammed Leonard to the floor, stalking fish was far from her mind. But when one yelled, "You got any guns? Better tell us now, lady!" That's what she thought about. The little pneumatic spear gun she'd bought in Nassau. They brandished only a machete and an old scarred baseball bat. Big men, heavy-handed, and barefooted, their pants wet up to the crotch, meaning they'd come by boat.
Why would we? She responded. Just tell us what you want. You can have it, anything. But for God's sake, take your damn hands off him.
Amazing how calmly the words came out, despite the way she was shaking.
Anything? That might be good if you was prettier, the man said. Kick that damn phone toward me, or I'll beat his head in.
The phone was on the floor where she'd dropped it. Once he'd pocketed the thing, he turned his attention to Leonard.
So you the professor, huh? Mister, you better cooperate and stop your damn fighting. I ain't that marshmallow sandman.
So that's why they were here. Lydia said,
Easy, let's all calm down. Leo, goddamn it, do what he says. We've got money, lots of it, cash. You can have it all as long as you promise not to hurt us. Leo's your name?
The men were smiling behind their masks.
Best listen to the lady, Leo. What we hear is she's a witch. From her looks, sure enough, could be true, aye?
More laughter. They had Leonard face down on the floor by then, arms behind his back. She cringed when he tried to kick free, and one of the men responded by kicking him hard in the ribs. The whimpering sound he made was childlike.
Heartbreaking.
Two involuntary steps. She started to charge, then caught herself.
Do that again. I won't tell you where it is. Say what?
The man with the bat scanned the room and saw the logbook lying open on the desk. He flipped through a few pages.
"'Pears to me this here's part of what we want. And even in a house this fancy won't be no problem finding the rest. That big plastic case where y'all folks keep your dive gear what I might need is the key.'
Then to his partner he said,
"'You got the tape? Find the damn tape while I see if the thing's too big to float out.
Sandman says it's heavy.
Our money's not in the case, Lydia said. Look all you want, you won't find it. But I'll show you if you promise.
Leonard drowned her out with threats about his connections in the U.S. Embassy and the Bohemian police. Both men focused on him, but one turned long enough to say,
Yeah, all the money you got, and bring that key while you're at it.
At a robotic pace, Lydia's raspberry high heels clip-clopped across the lacquered floor into the master suite. From the kitchen, the sound of a thud and another childlike whimper finalized her decision. Sliding doors opened to a porch that circled the house. She kicked off the shoes and ran barefooted, while Leonard hollered more threats from inside. Beyond the railing was the sea and stars, a sizable boat anchored off the beach. No sign of the man dressed in white, where tiki torches blazed by the pool. Piled near the outdoor shower was their snorkel gear. The pneumatic spear gun was short, easy to maneuver, but it was difficult to load because of a high-pressure piston that powered the spear like a bullet. The shaft loader was heavy plastic. She braced it between her feet. The spear was stainless steel, the point sharp as a stiletto. The head was attached by wire to a hinged barb that prevented a fish, or anything else, from pulling free once it had pierced flesh. Click! A pneumatic metal sound confirmed the shaft was locked, powered, and ready. Safety off, she crept to the front of the house, where the door was still open. Light spilled out onto palm fronds. The shadow of a man dwarfed her own shadow as she approached, spear gun up, shouldered like a rifle. She risked a quick look. One man was on his knees, facing inside. He was still battling to tape Leonard's hands, his machete on the floor within reach of the doorway. The man with the bat was standing with his back to the others. She listened to him call toward the master suite.
"What the hell's taking you so long, witchy woman?"
That's when Lydia appeared in the opening, close enough to shoot him in the spine, which is what she hollered.
"I'll shoot you in the goddamn spine if you turn around."
An nonsensical threat, since it forced him to spin toward her. The other man turned, too, but not before she'd knelt and grabbed the machete, then lofted it overhead, ready to swing.
"Goddamn, girl, give me that! Hey, easy now! What you got there?"
"Spear gun," the man on his knees said softly. He was trying to scoot out of range, but was blocked by Leonard, who was on his belly trying to get to his feet.
"Let him up. Get away from him," she hollered. "Not till you give me my sword back, I won't."
That's what locals called machetes in the islands, swords, a holdover from pirate times. Lydia aimed the spear gun, the man's face only 5 feet away, then lobbed the machete over the railing without looking to see where it landed.
"Go find it if you want the damn thing, and get out of here. Not you," she aimed at the other man. "Not until you drop that damn bat." "What if I don't? One little spear against two of us?"
Slowly, he began to move away from a spear that had a range of 10 feet max.
"You idiots, don't make me do this. I'm giving you a chance. Leave now. We won't call the police."
She extended the gun at the man on his knees.
"Tell him. Tell your buddy. Leave us in peace, and—"
Leonard ended that possibility when he lunged, snatched the baseball bat, and tried to roll out of the reach of a man twice his size. It was so unexpected, Lydia froze long enough for the other one to charge from his knees and knock her backward. She clung to the spear gun while he pried at her hands, then hit her with something, his fist, no doubt, and it felt like an exploding light in her head. A hammering sound pierced the haze, pistons of a diesel engine that reminded her of being at sea, except the cadence was random. Fleshy thuds were interspersed with yelps, wild profanities, panicked bare feet thumped wood, more profanity, then Leonard's face parted the haze. He was above her, wonderful to see in the starlight. "Lydia, babe, are you okay? Let me help you up." She was on her feet, a little woozy, but not too bad. It took a minute before she was lucid enough to piece together the chaos that had taken place. On the kitchen floor were splotches of red syrup. Blood. Blood on Leonard's face, his hands, and on the bat he now offered her as a cane.
"This might help. Can you walk? If that son of a bitch hurt you."
In the dark yard, a man was crawling, stumbling toward the beach. Another was almost to the water, his bulk visible amid a stand of coconut palms.
"Leon," she said, a name she'd never used before, gave it a regal pronunciation that slipped from her lips as Leon. It fit.
He was pumped up enough to taunt their attackers.
"There's more where that came, buster. Insult my lady again, you'll see, a witch my ass."
The man dressed in white. Where had he gone? Lydia's gaze moved from the swimming pool area to the pools of blood in the kitchen, then to the thief outside, crawling to get away.
"Oh, dear God, Leo, he's hurt really bad. How many times did you—"
"With the bat, I mean. Fuck him, I didn't have a choice. I hope he fucking dies."
Leonard cupped his head in his hands, the reality of what had happened settling in.
Oh, damn, maybe I did.
He paced briefly, then, from the railing, hollered, "Hey, buddy, are you okay? If you need a doctor, I'm willing to help. No hard feelings, man. What do you say?" The thief got to his feet. Maybe he looked back, or maybe didn't. It was too dark to be sure, then stumbled toward the shadows, a glistening wedge of sea beyond. Oh, Christ, now what do we do? Call the police, I guess. Report them before they...
No police,
Lydia said, grabbing his arm. You were in the right. They would have robbed us, maybe killed us, too. We've got to make a decision. We can't stay here.
Yeah. Could have killed us, Leonard reasoned, pulling away.
Then we have nothing to worry about from the police. Where's the goddamn phone? Only then did she remember a call from someone named Tomlinson. Next, an image of the phone on the floor came into her head. The robber had stuck it in his pocket.
Thank God that's all they took, she said.
What, the logbook? Leonard hurried into the main room.
No, it's still on the desk where I... The phone!
You can stop looking for the phone. Besides, we've registered under fake names at every place we stayed. How do you think that will go over if you call the police?
Leo, think about the logbook and the coins.
Fitzpatrick has had more than 3 weeks to report the theft, so they'll know about that, too.
Leonard wanted to inspect her forehead. He got her under the light, concerned, already close to an emotional meltdown.
You need an ice pack, he said.
Then in the kitchen he put his hands on the counter and appeared to sag.
Shit, shit, shit! What if one of them dies?
If he dies, he dies, she responded. We didn't ask them to break in with the baseball bat and a machete. The coin dealer you were supposed to meet, is he staying at the lodge or on a boat? She was worried about the man in white. If he wasn't behind the attempted robbery, he might misrepresent what he'd witnessed to the police if they showed up. There was a reason Lydia did not trust the guy. Leonard was wringing his hands, pacing. Okay, okay, here's what to do. I want you to fly back to Florida tomorrow.
That's right, as soon as there's a flight.
Yeah, that's what we'll do. Then I'll turn myself in.
None of this was your idea. I'll swear to it.
Here, he opened the fridge and packed a Ziploc with ice. This will stop the swelling. Lydia wanted to kiss the man. She did. Had to get up on her tiptoes to do it.
That's a lie, Leo. This was all my idea, she said.
It was an admission that required a longer talk, but not now. A tequila and triple sec calmed him while she used a mop to clean the floor.
We need to leave tonight. You said there was a boat for sale at the marina you liked. It's not even 10 o'clock, and the music goes until midnight.
Again she asked about the coin dealer.
What's it matter? I ran into the guy while you were napping. He owns a big-ass yacht, so I figured he might be interested. I never said he was a coin dealer. How's your head?
The ice had helped.
Did you approach him, or was it the other way around?
Yes. No. In fact, he came up to me and just sort of started talking. It didn't seem odd at the time, but now...
You don't think...
A spark came into his eyes.
We're on the run, Lydia said, and as of tonight, not just from the police. Maybe we should rent a room at the resort and see what happens. No one will bother us with a lot of people around.
I want to talk to that coin guy first. Pack your stuff, I mean it. No more discussion.
Leon had spoken.
It was the same Leon who waited until they were at the bar with a couple of rum punches to reflect with a hint of surprise.
You were right. No one seems to know or care what happened, or why I waited this late to ask to see the dockmaster.
But the weirdest part about tonight, Lydia, I'm serious. I don't remember ever feeling more, you know, alive.
8. In the morning, Ford swam a quarter mile along the beach and jogged back to find a stranger seated on a stump outside his rental cottage. Human males do a visual appraisal automatically, because their olfactory powers are weak. Caucasian, tanned, with some burning, mid-30s, 6'2", 180, delicate hands, a tourist fly fisherman, clothes a techno flag of expensive miracle fibers, money, privileged class, a possible threat, but not the bust-your-head type. This was not the ex-military cage fighter Tomlinson had warned him about, and nothing like the close call last night with Purcell. He slowed to a walk. If you're looking for bonefish, I saw a couple of schools on my run. Do you mind? The stump blocked a sandy path to the outdoor shower. The man got up, saying, Dr. Ford?
I pictured you younger. But looks like you're still in fairly good shape, considering.
Want me to toss you a towel?
This subtle barb was the first red flag. And one flag was enough. Tell you what, come back and knock, then introduce yourself. That's how it's supposed to work. Half an hour ought to do. I already knocked. Try again, maybe your luck will change. It already has. She wouldn't answer, so I waited. That's how it works in my world.
Ford looked at the man, then passed him, seeing a screened porch where a swimsuit, panties, a bra too, hung drying on a line. The cottage was tiny, one room, its roof of tin dented by coconuts from palms that shaded this stretch of beach. Inside, a woman's silhouette appeared near an open window, then disappeared, where she might be able to hear if they moved closer.
"Let's get out of the sun," Ford said, and walked to a pair of chairs near a hammock. "Why not start by telling me why you're acting like such an asshole?"
The man decided a stare-down was unwise.
"I get impatient, so sue me. I've always been this way. I'm doing you a favor if you'll give me a chance. Impatient people can end up being patients."
It took a second.
"Oh, I get it. Like in a hospital. A sense of humor. I didn't expect bad jokes, either."
The man was working on a book, he claimed, about a modern pirate who was jailed for contempt after refusing to reveal where he'd stashed millions in gold bars and coins. His first book, the man said, and it might require a pen name because Jamie Middlebrook was too bland. Plus, in stores, you had to get on your knees to see the M-shelf. "What do you think of Sebastian Bunch?"
"One's as believable as the other," Ford replied.
"What does this have to do with me?"
He'd been warned about a journalist, too. But Middlebrook, whatever his name was more likely an Ivy League recruit hired by some federal agency. Over the years, he had dealt with enough to know. A plausible cover story, clothes too new, an ingratiating, hard-on manner that suggested electronic intel and access to Black Hawk helicopters, if necessary.
"I'm getting to that," Middlebrook said. He gave the cottage a look.
"Why don't you ask her to come out? Might save us all some time."
"Think of me as a filtering device," Ford said. "It's a term biologists use, and time is something you're running low on. Start by explaining how you know my name, and that I'd be gone long enough for you to case the place."
"I'm a thief, sure. That's why I chose your palatial rental cabin to rob. Now who's being an asshole?"
"I'm in sort of a rush. They don't teach social skills at Princeton or wherever it was you majored in, what, political science? International law? Those used to be the favorites. I suppose it could be computers now."
The man's face went blank.
"What's that supposed to mean?"
"Middlebrook," Ford shrugged. "Isn't that the name of a famous brokerage house or bank or something? New England, so I figured a family business."
"That explains it," the man said, but wasn't convinced.
"As I was saying, the guy I'm writing about started a company called Benthic Exploration. A really fascinating character. Then conned his investors out of a bundle. That's who took him to court first. His investors. Jimmy Jones. Does the name ring a bell?"
Ford, wearing just shorts, started to get up, a towel around his neck.
"I'm going to shower and have breakfast. When you get to how this concerns me, wave. Dr. Leonard Nickleby, does that name ring a bell?"
The man smiled, pleased by the effect.
"Finally, I have your attention."
"What about him?"
"Like I said, I'm trying to do you a favor. Don't take this the wrong way, Dr. Ford. You should stick to fish and give up playing amateur detective. Personally, I don't care about the old fool. Take him home to his nightmare of a wife and your pal's logbook while you're at it. Lydia Johnson is the one I want to find. Lydia worked for Benthic as a low-rung gopher, or so the feds and everyone else believed at the time. I don't suppose you know where they're hiding?"
"Nightmare is a cruel way to describe the woman who's paying you," Ford countered. "Or is it just expenses and enough information to get you this far?"
Again the sharp look of surprise. It faded.
"You'd have to meet the woman to understand, but you're right. She wouldn't have told me a damn thing if I'd used any other approach. Like I'm actually going to write about her husband if he doesn't come home?
Lydia is all I care about. I need to find her before someone else does. No shit. Jimmy ran off with $400 million in gold, and she might be the only one who knows where he stashed it. Maybe you read about him being beaten to death in prison a few weeks ago? How much? Almost half a billion reasons for you not to get involved. As a biologist, you might be unaware there are people who'd kill for a lot less. Ford settled into his chair, not meek, but willing to listen. I'm not naive. That's why I think you're exaggerating. What if I'm not? Is it worth betting your life? Hers, too? Another nod toward the porch. And anyone else who has information on that pair? Middlebrook saw the reaction he'd hoped for. Good. You're a reasonable man. Most are when it comes to that much money. When you say ran off, how much would $400 million in gold weigh? You have to admit what you're saying is hard to believe. Not really. Figure around $16,000 a pound, so a little over 4,000 pounds, it would fill a space about the size of two refrigerators. Easy enough to move even with a fairly small boat. Up to a ton, maybe. Ford nodded. It's a lot more manageable, you breaking it down like that. Even a recreational trawler could handle the load, sure. Middlebrook liked that response, too. Let me give you the backstory. The SS Panama went down during a boom period after the Civil War. It carried 15 tons in gold ingots, for starters, a shipment ordered secretly by the U.S. Treasury. Add another 2 tons in gold bars, paid for in advance by the Spanish Mint. You didn't read about this? I wouldn't waste my time looking for a logbook that belongs to some third-rate treasure hunter. No offense, I'm sure Mr. Fitzpatrick's a good guy and all, but get yourself killed in the process? You strike me as too smart for that. Obviously not, Ford smiled. If I look up Benthic Exploration and the rest, the numbers won't change. Worth more, according to some. As much as $600 million. Spain wants its cut, and so does the U.S. government. I've heard certain factions in El Salvador claim the gold is theirs, too, because that's where it was mined. Believe me, when news got out about Jimmy's death, the mercenary types started polishing their resumes. You really want to get caught in the middle of that? Jesus. A perfect political storm. Afraid so. You came on like such a jerk. I guess it's possible I overreacted. Don't worry about it. How'd you know I contacted Nickleby's wife? Fitz is the old friend of a friend, Ford said. That's what I figured. Did he say anything about Lydia Johnson? Not even her last name. And I certainly didn't know she was involved with... I'm not the only one who thinks so. There's no hard evidence, but after eliminating almost everyone else, it's what you might call a well-researched hunch. I know this much for certain. Nickleby's wife has a big mouth. If you and your pals know those two are in the Bahamas, how many others do you think are aware? I didn't have any trouble tracking you down, Dr. Ford. Think about it. Ford appeared concerned. The way it started was, I was here on a project anyway. So I thought, why not poke around, ask a few questions and help Fitz? Sort of fun, you know, but now, Jesus, I had no idea what I was walking into. The resume thing, what I meant is, forget about common thieves and murderers. The behind-the-scenes power brokers will send in pros, experts who'd torture to get information. Then the man swiped a finger across his throat. That's why I have to watch my ass every step of the way. Difference is, I knew the score, you didn't. So I thought a friendly warning was in order. I hope I can trust you not to blab this around. Not if it all checks out. I guess that'll have to do for now. There's someone else who wouldn't talk to me, Hubert Purcell. But he was very protective of you. He said, don't mess with the biologist like you were buddies, that you'd done him a big favor and he owed you. What did he mean by that? Ford shared a partial truth about fixing Purcell's GPS before getting back to Lydia Johnson. I was an idiot not to do an internet search before I left Androstown. Instead, I researched Nickleby. $400 million, Jesus Christ. And I'm worried about Fitzpatrick's logbook. You wouldn't have found much on her. Lydia's not new to this game. She spent the last 6 years living under the radar. Fake IDs and a bunch of aliases. She and Nickleby would do the same thing until Lydia cuts him loose, and she will, when she doesn't need a boyfriend and the logbook story has cover. But there's one thing those two can't fake. Any idea what that is? Yes. Diver certification cards. Unless they were willing to lug scuba tanks and buy an air compressor, there was no getting around it. The Bahamian government monitored dive shops weekly. One screw up and the owner was out of business. But Ford replied, "The color of their skin, I suppose. No, that's wrong. There are thousands of native white Bahamians." "I got it. Their fingerprints." Middlebrook got to his feet, smiling. "Obviously. Look, consider this an introduction. How about we get together this afternoon for drinks, then stroll over and have a chat with Purcell? I'm half a mile down the beach, the Red House. You know the one? It sits off by itself." That explained a lot. Half an hour ago, Ford had swam past the place. "I have a meeting this afternoon off-island, so how about tonight? Around 9 should be good."
"The sooner the better. And bring her, now that you understand."
He didn't bother to reference the cottage.
"Just talking with those two has put her in danger. And, from what I heard, she's had enough tragedy for one life. I'll go easy with the questions."
Inside a cottage window, the blinds moved, while Ford asked, "What are you talking about?"
"Like you don't know. Her husband and kid drowned a couple of years back. He was drunk."
Middlebrook interpreted surprise as doubt.
"Don't play dumb. I know she's in there. I would have found her last night if she hadn't gone back to using her maiden name. So tell her she can trust me, okay?"
"Tell who?"
"Jesus, you're a stubborn bastard. The dive shop owner. Tamarinda Constance is the name on the sign, but she took out the mortgage as Tamarinda Gatrell. That's what threw me."
9. A text from Tomlinson. When irony and lust collide, the detritus paints life as a hilarious absurdity. Don't fall for that nihilist bullshit. A second text was meant to be funny. "At least she's your second cousin, which is legal in border states and a few backward countries. Thank God you know who is in Spain, far from the TCT. Go and sin some more." You know who, Tucker Gatrell, was also Ford's cousin. TCT stood for the Coconut Telegraph, which was sort of funny, but only because Tomlinson had assumed the worst or bawdiest scenario after learning that Tamara had spent the night at the cottage. Ford, smiling, pocketed the phone. He had tailed Middlebrook to a red beach rental just to prove he could, then flew his mole amphib to a resort 60 miles east off Stanley Cay. Hubert Purcell's boat was anchored near the fuel dock, as prearranged. That was 2 hours ago. The name of the resort was Silver Reef. It was an island fantasy with beach estates, a casino, and yachts, and a wafer of sand dwarfed by the enormity of the sea. A call to Tomlinson from a hotel landline was easily arranged. The staff was less cooperative when it came to questions about Nickleby and Lydia Johnson, who'd checked in 4 days earlier. After he was done snooping, he joined Purcell aboard the Sandman to await something else that had been prearranged, a meeting with his Haitian drinking pals. That's where Ford was, near the helm with a view of the water as Tomlinson's second text pinged in.
"Why are you smiling, boss?"
Purcell's deference was irritating after almost coming to blows last night. The fight might have happened if Ford hadn't proved he could fix the boat's GPS. Interrogation skills and a bottle of Bacardi had played a role. "Something a friend sent," Ford said amiably. "Call me Doc, okay? You're the captain, I'm just a client." Ford nodded toward the channel. "Is that who we're waiting on?" A dilapidated lobster boat had entered the basin and turned their way, a lone man at the wheel.
"One of them, anyway."
Purcell swiveled around in the captain's chair, got up, then decided he didn't need binoculars.
"Yep, Quarles is what he goes by. Too bad I was expecting three other fellows, too. Let me talk to him private-like, okay?"
So they could get their stories straight, Ford assumed, yet maintained an easygoing approach.
"Whatever you say. When you're ready, give me a wave. I'd like to meet him." "Not right off, man. I think he'd come here alone for a reason. The others are probably worried you're the police after what your friend said happened."
Last night, Tomlinson's call to Nickleby had ended with a woman, probably Lydia, screaming before the phone went dead. Purcell frowned at the lobster boat.
Lord, what's wrong with his face? Looks like Quarrel's been beaten.
Even from a distance, the facial swelling was noticeable.
Yeah, man, he all buggered up. I'm afraid whatever them Haitians did was bad. Don't matter what the dockmaster told you, the group that fella runs with are the ones I warned you about. Same that laughed 'cause I was too cool, restrained myself, after the professor showed his foolishness.
Ford responded, It takes a big man to walk away from a fight.
There you go. But they like meanness. The staff here knows Quarrels, all them boys from Haiti, so they're afraid to speak the truth. But don't you worry. Sandman gonna find out what you need to know.
The man, surprisingly nimble, went down the ladder and waited with his stern line ready. There wasn't much Ford didn't know after his stroll around the resort. He sat and waited, and kept an eye on Purcell and Quarrels below. Nickleby and the girl weren't registered at the resort, according to a clerk he'd spoken with. They'd checked out, in the words of the dockmaster, who'd accepted $20 in exchange for information. The name Nickleby was unfamiliar, but he recognized Ford's description of a small, bald American traveling with a much younger girl. A talkative man, the dockmaster, when properly motivated.
Oh, those two, yes, sir, Leon, is what he told me. She, I think he called her Lady Anne, or Lydia Anne. Our scrape and rake band plays so loud it was hard to hear.
Leon or Leon? Ford had asked.
Like he was Spanish. Your friends had themselves quite a party last night up there at the Red Parrot. There was dancing to reggae and a bit drunk, you remind me saying. Rum punch, I believe, was their drink of choice, which is the dancingest drink on this island. Only reason I met them was the bartender summoned me from my room at Staff House. Mr. Leon was interested in a boat we got listed. See that little Grand Banks sitting over yonder?
Nickleby didn't buy the boat, so Ford pushed the conversation along. Last night the pair had booked a room in the hotel, possibly because the lady had fallen and hit her head. This made sense to the dockmaster. Why else move their luggage from the most beautiful house on the property? And the most private. The rum punches had fixed her up fine, no swelling around the temple, unless the light was just right.
Maybe they went back to the house when they checked out of the hotel. No, sir, they're for sure gone. Can't sneeze on this island without folks noticing. Must have chartered a plane after Mr. Leon decided that Grand Banks needed too much work. That had to be before first light. My job starts early. I'd have seen a hired boat.
They didn't leave without paying their bill, I hope.
Doubt that, sir. The gentleman had plenty of money, or the bartender wouldn't have summoned me last night. It was close to 11 by the time I was dressed proper to greet clients. By then, those two had the guests, and most the staff, too, on their feet, doing what we call the snake crawl, but others call a conga line.
Professor Leonard Nickleby. Ford mused, pleased with the incongruity.
Mr. Leon and Lady Anne is how the staff speaks of them, the dockmaster responded. They are a fun pair, those two. Oh, and there is something else I heard. Well, I probably shouldn't say, even with you being friends of theirs and all.
Another 20 changed hands. Prior to taking the dance floor, Nickleby and the girl had been aboard a yacht. They'd returned to the bar with a satchel of cash. Blocks of hundreds, U.S. it looked like. The bartender had gotten a peek.
Which boat?
The docks were a latticework of sports fishermen, sailboats and blue-water cruisers, all large enough to be considered yachts.
Man that rents it pulled out this morning, the dockmaster said. They weren't aboard, if that's what you're wondering. I would have noticed when I loaded the gentleman's luggage.
What kind of boat? Maybe I know him.
I couldn't say, sir. What I was told was he'd come here a few years back and made a movie picture. Don't know the name of that either. Just that them Hollywood people do love their partying.
The owner must be famous.
Anyone else you could ask? No, sir. A private plane, that was Mr. Leon's most likely choice. I suggest you wait. I'm sure you don't want a good friend like you to spend vacation alone. Is that all, sir?
It was, as far as the dockmaster was concerned. He wouldn't discuss the owner or describe the yacht. A $50 bill was refused.
One more thing, Ford had pressed. Are you sure there's not another way they could have left?
The landing strip here doesn't have lights. The dockmaster hadn't considered that.
Dog it if you ain't right. Couldn't have been a plane, nope, unless—wait, the mailboat. Today's Thursday, and Thursdays She pulls out early from the commercial key north of here. Maybe they bought tickets.
Bound for where?
Lots of stops. Exumas, Sapphire Creek, Arthur's Town, maybe far as the Ragged Islands. I can grab you a schedule from the office. Mailboats how all us islanders travel, sir. Always been that way, but I don't recommend it for guests. Too slow for folks in a hurry to have fun.
Ford had returned to the Sandman, schedule in hand. The same schedule he opened when Purcell climbed down from the bridge to greet the dilapidated lobster boat. It was almost 6, nearly time to head back to Andros. He put the schedule away and walked to an aft window, where there was a view of mangroves and a swath of sand where his seaplane was anchored. The fuselage appeared darker than the popsicle blue water. A window starboard side was a better place to observe Purcell. So far the giant had not invited their visitor aboard. Quarles, a muscular 200 pounds, appeared slight by comparison. He wore baggy pants, a rope for a belt, no shirt. His face was grotesquely swollen like a plum was growing from his ear. The fist of a powerful man might have caused the damage. Or a hammer. Lydia Johnson had a head injury, too, according to the dockmaster. Maybe it was coincidence. Maybe not. Last night, the GPS and a bottle of Bacardi had put Hubert Purcell in the mood to admit he was worried about something. It concerned his Haitian friends, Quarles among them. That's all he would say, at first. Ford had been through enough schools to know that empathy and liquor were the most effective tools of interrogation. Half a bottle had loosened the big man's tongue. It was possible, Purcell admitted, that he had bragged at too many bars that access to Nickleby's equipment case and a logbook were worth a punch in the face from a little fellow like him. And he might have hinted the logbook was better at finding ambergris than treasure. A puffy little professor and a girl would be easy targets if handled correctly, something his friends could have figured out on their own. Purcell had offered Ford the same deal he'd probably offered his drinking buddies.
You and me should partner up before them Haitians take what's not theirs. And the book's not the only reason. You say it don't belong to the professor? Let me tell you about something else that don't belong to him. The 50-50 split of whatever we sell. That'll be thanks enough, plus my normal charter fee, of course.
Purcell knew what was in the equipment case. He had palmed the keys while Nickleby was in the water, or so he believed at the time. Inside was a lot of expensive gear. There was also a small waterproof box.
Two of the prettiest Spanish coins I've ever seen is in there. One was bright, shiny silver, the other gold and shiny, but twice as big. Prof. Leo had carved out spaces in the foam. You know the kind of box I mean? A third space was empty, which explained why him and the girl had cash to charter my boat. Probably stolen, all three. Then they cheated me out of $30,000 by selling ambergris I found.
Ford had asked where they'd found the ambergris, and how it involved the logbook, before hearing the rest of it.
Me looking in that box is what led to the misunderstanding I mentioned. Know why? Because I was too fair-minded even when that little fool hit me. Thieves is what they are. Here, look at these pictures.
Purcell had pulled out his phone.
Tell me if it's worth going after what we both know don't belong to them.
There was a blurry photo of a silver Spanish real. In better focus, a larger coin, gold, ornate, a robust die. At the base, die marks read Tricentennial 1714. Ford had never seen a coin like it. At the bar, how many people saw these pictures as you passed the phone around? Many, judging from Purcell's indignant denial. More questions had produced more lies before Ford offered his own deal in a friendly, empathetic way. I hope your pals didn't do anything stupid. The police could get the wrong idea and arrest you, too.
You think?
That's the way they'll see it, I'm afraid.
Oh, shit, yeah. Those boys too dumb to do anything that ain't stupid. You speak on my behalf, won't you, sir? I hear you got official papers from the Crown.
If I can help, Ford had said. Wouldn't it be better to give your friends a call, maybe arrange a meeting before something bad does happen? I'd hate to see you in jail. Tell you what, I'll charter your boat for a couple of days, then fly over and meet you at wherever it was you dropped Dr. Nickleby and the girl.
Why there? because the police can't arrest you for preventing a crime. And Nickleby can't say much if we lay claim to what didn't belong to him in the first place. Just like you said. The mix of larceny and reason